Joe Buck had the call at the very first game ever played at the new Busch Stadium. Chris Ronji with Cardinal World Series champ Brad Thompson. I'm Randy Carricker, and we head to the Brown and Crouppen Celebrity Line, and the Cardinals Hall of Fame manager Tony La Russa, kind enough to join us on what we're calling Hopening Day, hoping that there will be an opening day. Skipper, always good to talk to you. How you doing?
Well, like everybody else, impatient and trying not to be bored.
How's that going for you, Skipper?
Well, you know, if you try hard enough, you can, you know, I'm not very handy, so I can't go to the workshop, but I can figure out things.
How many animals do you have at the house right now?
Well, the problem is that because I spent so much time with 80 guys in Arizona, by the time that I was cleared to leave, the state in California got locked down, and if I went there, I had a period of isolation, so I just stayed in Arizona.
I guess.
Be safe and not risk anything to my wife and daughters.
Well, that's a smart call, and we wish you and your family all the best in a crazy time. And I know we're going to talk about baseball, but everybody knows there's bigger things going on than sports. Hey, Tony, that highlight that we heard coming in, that was Albert's home run. It was the first home run at New Busch Stadium by a Cardinal in Busch 3. And that was my first ever opening day. That was my first experience doing that. You have had so many opening days throughout your career, but I'm really interested in your first one in 1996 as skipper of the Cardinals. How well do you remember that?
Well, like it was yesterday, Brad, because I had heard about the festivities as soon as I got in a uniform in spring training, you know, talking to Buddy Bates and CJ and, you know, people that are close to the Cardinals for years, Judy Barrett, you know, it goes on and on. They pumped it up, you know, and I kept thinking, well, it's one of those things, can't be as good as they say it is, and it was even better. Because I remember coming to the World Series in 82, 5, and 7 and just got thrilled with the Clydesdales. And that was my number one, you know, wish is just to see those things, and that really kicked it off perfectly.
Hey, outside of winning the World Series, seeing you on opening day with the Clydesdales might be the only times I've seen you smile.
Well, I mean, you know, you have that one face that you put out there for everybody else, but as Brad will tell you, you know, in the clubhouse, you know, I'm a real clown, and I lack in intensity and urgency. It's hard for me to get serious.
I mean, that was Brad. That was me. I never, you didn't smile at me. No. Oh. Tony, well, I'm kidding. No, seriously, you love those animals, though. I remember distinctly you sitting there petting the Clydesdales. I mean, that was a happy moment for you before a game.
It was. In fact, I think it was the last time last year I took a picture, and I've got it in my album. I took a picture standing between the front two, and they snapped it once and twice, and just as they snapped a second one, the one on my left, on my left, nudged me in the like he was giving me a kiss, and you'll see a smile there. That's the best smile I can ever on my face. But you know, it's just like even now we're talking about these times. You know, a bunch of us are sharing videos about what dogs and cats, you know, just naturally they, you know, unconditionally love they provide you, and they, you know, they're clueless about what's happening, and they're just miraculous therapy for all of us.
As for the stuff that actually happens on the field on opening day, is there something you remember most, something that truly sticks out for you?
As you know, you're asking to pick between great and greater and greatest. I know that opening day was something like camera day or family day. You know, it's just a day where it's always mirrored, the players could, you know, enjoy the celebration, and then just a few minutes later, click on that competitive concentration. If I had to pick one, I probably would go with 1998 with all the hoopla that Mark McGwire caused in the last part of 97 and going to spring training and everybody asking him about the Ruth and Maris record. And I think he had a grand slam off of Ramon Martinez. I think that just shook that place and just thrilled everybody. And it was, you know, it showed what was ahead if we'd have known it.
The Hall of Famer Tony La Russa joining us here in the Fast Lane on 101 ESPN. And these are such strange times, Tony. This is the first time that we will not have had an April game in baseball since the 1800s. Every other year, even with wars and everything else that's gone on, we've had April baseball. It's just so strange. And as you can imagine, here in St. Louis, when we're supposed to have the home opener today, but across our country, to not have baseball is just really strange.
Yeah, it's strange. It's, you know, it's weird. It's frustrating, disappointing. And then, but I've heard it, you know, stated so well by so many people. Just keep everything in its context, and, you know, it's an entertainment. It's a sport, and it pales in comparison. So, you know, you can be frustrated, but, you know, it doesn't even approach concern and seriousness of what the virus is causing to each of the individuals in our country and around the world. So I do believe, though, that, that, you know, one thing about baseball, I mean, I think all sports contribute, but baseball, the fact that it's 6 months every day, basically, it gets to be a habit that people look forward to, mostly at night, sometimes during the day. And I really think I've been hearing it, you know, probably from several hundred people who've gotten in touch with me. They really miss it. And looking forward to getting back out there.
Well, even a day like today, Skipper, has been a nice distraction. You know, talking about opening day, talking about memories in general. And when baseball does come back, it'll be a big healing moment because that means everything else is going all right. Tony, I want to ask you, when you took over in 96, you told us the memories of the opening day. But I'm interested, being around you, every day is a win or a loss, and I love that. And I learned so much about competing from you, just watching you go about your business every day. And you believe that you're going to set out to win the day. You've got your goals. That being said, when did you have your first team with the St. Louis Cardinals? Maybe it was 96. But that you truly came into opening day and said, we have got a legit chance to win the World Series.
Well, there was so much uncertainty in 96, Brad. I mean, you know, brand new was really getting together in spring training with some of the young guys and also some of the veterans. You know, we did bring in some Oakland A's, you know, several teammates, several coaching staff. But we were really feeling our way as far as getting that unified feeling. In fact, 96 is one of my favorite seasons to reflect on, just to show you how if you're relentless and you keep pursuing the right thing, how it you can pay you back. Because around June, the club figured it out, you know, that they're better off together than separate, that it really was more fun in a lot of ways to win when you're competing. And you know, from then on, you know, we sprinted to the end and ended up getting close to the World Series. So at the beginning of the season, you know, we had a nice spring, but there was so much uncertainty you can't put it in the same context as later on. Once we got into 2000, you know, there was almost every year you knew there was a way for us to get to October. And if you got to October, we had a chance to win it all.
Your 2000 team wins 95 games. At what point that season did you know? Because you had some good teams leading up to it. But never like that. Not with the Cardinals, anyway. That was the first time that it was a truly, really good team. When did you know it? When did you know that season those guys were really good?
Well, I really believe it's similar to right now. You know, they're on the president's butt for being hopeful. You know, I think when you lead, you best lead with a positive message and expectation, but then you prepare for the worst. So it's not like you ignore. So, you know, you go into the season with a positive expectation, but you want to be realistic. You don't want to be telling the club you're a World Series contender if you believe that you were not complete and a lot of things would have had to fall in place. That's not really – it's unfair pressure. 2000, I started to have that good vibe, and so did our staff, once Walt Jacoby and his – the ops group, you know, the scouts and everybody, once they made the moves to add Daryl Kyle, and sooner or later it was Jim Edmonds, and we signed Mike Matheny, I mean, Dave Veers. As soon as we put those pieces in with what we had, we thought, man, you know, now we're checking just about every box, and we were excited that we could play in October.
Tony La Russa with us on 101 ESPN. And Tony, it's interesting. We talked to Karp earlier, and I asked him about how proud he is of the fact that that leadership that was put in place, kind of a leadership philosophy among the starters with Hengen and Kyle and Bennis in 2000, and it still exists to this day. What about you? How much pride do you take in the fact that now you've got Wainwright and Flaherty that are still carrying on those same traditions that your team started here?
Well, I enjoy it. I made a contribution. So the other coaches, the major contribution came from our pitching coach, Dave Duncan and Marty Mason. But I also think that you got to acknowledge that you're walking into a situation where the historic accomplishments, the expectations, and never more so than opening day when you shake hands and there's Stan and Red and Lou and Bob and Whitey and Ozzy. I mean, they're looking at you and they're saying, hey, you know what you got to do? You know what's expected of you? I mean, there is something to all that come through. But I do believe that one of the most essential things that happens is team leadership. And we were very fortunate in Chicago and in Oakland and St. Louis. It was second to none. Player-wise, we always had it. And pitching-wise, and you just describe it beautifully, when we got there in 96, Andy Bennis, Todd Stottlemyre were on that club. Later on, Pat Henken came along with Daryl Kyle and Matt Morris. You know, Alan Bennis was a star his first year. Look what Matt's become. And they just learned it by the time Adam came in, right? You know, then Karp, he had gotten an education in Toronto with Pat Henken and being around Roy Halladay. So it's just so healthy, and it's a beautiful thing to see. You see it passed on, and that's why it's good to keep Karp around, because when the new guys get there, if they ever start feeling like they're a little bigger than their britches, they just look at what guys like Karp and Wainwright have accomplished, and they better ask them, and I know they do, and they'll give them the ABCs, and it is a beautiful thing to see.
Tony, it's really interesting. A guy like Jack Flaherty, who's 24 years old, is in constant contact with Carpenter. Gibby left him his phone number, and he's in contact with Bob Gibson, too. Here's a 24-year-old right-hander. Have you had a chance to see much of Flaherty, and if so, what'd you think?
Well, he's just a stud. We have a grapevine, and, when you see a guy sign between Gary LaRocque, Mark DeJohn, and at that time, Mike Shelton, the organization, I get a heads up about who's special, what the talents are. Because what you learn is if you got talent, you sign a contract. But to be really special, it has to come from between the ears that translate to your heart and your guts. So, Flaherty was on the radar screen, except for as soon as he signed. Because guys that I respected were just glowing with, what his intangibles were. And then I watched, his rookie year, how he stood up there in these tough games, especially the second half of the year. And he's doing it, not like a flash in the pan. He's doing it with legitimate basics mentally and physically and mechanically. And I had one experience with him this winter where I just placed a call. I knew him, just meet him in the dugout and in the clubhouse a couple of times. Because he lived in California, I asked him if he could help Art. And he, without a doubt, he said, absolutely. And he signed some baseballs that helped us pay for our replaced roof. So I think he's a real stud, and I think he's pitching on a staff that's got some studs.
I think you're absolutely right there. He's got
and
that.
And by the way, I want to make sure I mention Mike Maddox was a great sign. I think I always think the players are the ones that are out to the pitchers, but look at the staffs, and I know Mike has got came over with great credentials, and he's doing it for the Cardinals now.
Yeah, good staff, good leadership. Hey, I want to go back to Karp for a second, Tony, because I love watching him work. I love watching the preparation. I love watching everything about him. He was a leader through and through. And not that it ever happened very often, but I'm sure that there was a time or two that you had to take the baseball away from Chris Carpenter. And I'm just wondering, and maybe the answer is not Karp, but it could be, I'm sure you have one top of mind. Was there somebody that you knew it was going to be a colorful conversation every time you went out there to take the baseball away from him?
Well, back to Chicago, my first experience was with the great Hall of Famer Tom Seaver, 84 and 85. And what a just an incredibly smart competitor and pitcher. So that was my first experience. And there's a story about it at some point. We have time to tell it now. But
he got all the time, Tony.
We're headed toward a game, Tony.
Yep. We don't have to do post-game.
Remind me to tell you the Seaver story. But then go to the A's. You know, there's Dave Stewart. You know, and as soon as I come out to it, give me that stare. And Bobby Welsh. You know, Mike Moore. They're top of the rotation guys, and it's their game to the finish. So that's why, you as soon as you walk out of the dugout, you point to the bullpen, because you want that decision to be made. Because they, you know, what are they going to do then? But in Carp's case, there was a lot of times he'd give me that look, like you know. And the only thing I would say to him, hey, Dunk agrees, and then he'd give me the ball. But he was not happy several times, but I'm going to make a point that I think is probably my number one pet peeve, and it's misunderstood. And Carp is a perfect example of it, although we have others that I could use. They would always talk about our teams that we were really prepared, which always bothered me, because it isn't preparing. You know, it's not studying for the test. You know, it's when you take the test, do you come ready to compete? And I thought the thing that separated our clubs for years, that nobody competed better than us. We played hard. We played for 9 innings. We tried to play the game correctly. And I think when you stop and say you prepare, that sounds like, you know, it became automatic and all we did was study. And you forget, here again, the head and the hearts of the guts that it takes when you actually go against somebody on the other team that has talent that's trying to beat you. And Carp was as much into the competition as Dave Stewart or Tom Seaver, anybody I've ever had. I mean, you know, Dennis Eckersley, I'm talking about Hall of Famers now. Carp, he was out there to help his team win. Whatever the stats were, at the end of the day, he wanted that W on his team's side. And I think he reflected the personality of our position players, our pitchers, our coaching staff, and everybody else that supported. We were there to compete and try to win the game.
Relentless. I mean, that's the thing with him, and that was, you know, you laid out there is that relentlessness that we all expected. All right, Tony, if you have the time, and I get it if you got somewhere to go, but I would love to hear the Seaver story if you have a second.
Okay, well, the background is my first year as a minor league manager, I was fortunate the farm director was a great, legendary old-timer named Paul Richards. A lot of you millennial guys will never know who Paul is. You're going to have to Google him. But Paul caught in the big leagues, and he was like standing up when he caught it. He goes that far back with a real round mitt and everything. Well, he went from a catcher to a front office to a manager. I mean, he was really creative. And when he was a farm director in 1978 and 79, I was a minor league manager, he did a lot of talking to us young managers about how to handle a pitching staff. And one of the things he said is that pitchers, by their nature, are heroes. He says, do not make the mistake of going out to the mound and ask the guy how he feels. Because a guy is always going to tell you, I can get him. He said, what you need to do is you need to make that decision based on what you see. And in our case, you know, for many, many years, you know, a lot of, you know, Dunk and I would, you know, do you see what I see? And it was, we Well, before Dave Duncan, before the Cardinals and the A's, in 1984, the White Sox acquired Tom Seaver. And I remember the year before, 83, that was our first postseason trip where I was the manager. We had won 99 games, won the West. In those days, imagine, you had a best of five to go to the World Series. Baltimore beat us in four games. So Seaver joins us. And he gets the ball opening day, and he's in his 30s. In spring training, you know, I saw him when he was in the Mets, Tom Terrific, you know, and he's just blowing pitches by guys. You know, and he had nice likeness, fastball, decent velocity, but he really was really commanding, and he had a great changeup, get a breaking ball. You know, because of his command, he could hit any zone on the plate. So I'm looking at a guy, you know, he's in his 30s, and, you know, he did everything, never missed a drill. We start the season in County Stadium, and it is raining, snow and sleet. And Seaver goes out there and five innings. I think they get like maybe two runs. He goes out there for the sixth. They're winning 4-2. And, you know, and I'm getting concerned. I don't care who he was as far as age. You know, when you pitch the first game of the season in those conditions, it really just beats the hell out of your energy level. So for anybody, I'd have been really careful. But with Tom, I thought, you know, he is a little older, right? Two guys get on. And I, his left-hand hitter named Jim Gantner comes up, and I go to the bullpen. I come out quickly, and I point to the bullpen, bring in the left-hander Juan Augusto. Well, it didn't work. Gantner laid out a bunt. We missed the bunt up. They scored three runs. We ended up losing the game, although Seaver wasn't the losing pitcher, right? The next day, as you know, same like St. Louis, they always protect the opener with an off day. So we're having a workout at County Stadium. You know, and I'm walking around, and I'm by the cage, and all of a sudden, I keep looking out the left field, and there's Seaver by himself. Guys would walk up to him, and he would tell him, see you later. And so I said, well, you know, Tom's really pissed off. He's really taking this loss hard. He says, well, I really think he's shooing him off because he's waiting for you to, when you're making your rounds, he wants to talk to you. So, hell, I walked out there, and we had this conversation. He cut it a little bit short. Basically, he said, respectfully, so what were you thinking when you took me out? So I gave him my ABCs, and then I said, well, that, you know, with a left-hand pitcher like Augusta, who was really a very good fielder, I thought it was a good time because I knew he would bounce that way and we'd maybe nullify the bunt attempt. So Seaver says to me, well, do you know my record? I said, yes, Tom, I know it. Well, believe it. He could go 0-20 for 5 years and be over 500. He's like 100 games over 500. He said, do you think that I had to feel my position in any one of those wins? Yes, Tom. He said, did you watch me in spring training? As a matter of fact, I did. You used to play a lot of pepper. Why'd you think I did that? Well, I knew you weren't. I was hoping you weren't just bored with my program. He says, well, I was a little bit, but I was trying to work on my fielding. So my point is that if you took me out because of the bunt, it's a bad decision. If you didn't like what I had, then I will never disrespect the manager. And then I told him a story about I've learned don't ask the pitchers. So this is gospel. From that day in 84 and for 2 years, 85. And by the way, we had some wonderful times together. We had a time where he won a 25-inning suspended game. He pitched the 25th inning the next day. Harold hit a homer on the bottom of the 25th. 20 minutes later, he took the mound because that was his day of start. Pitched 7 innings, won 2 games in 1 day. And we were in New York when he won 300 against the Yankees. So I love Tom Seaver. Learned so much from him. But we decided, and he told me, he says, Tony, you know, I know that I don't have the gas that I had and could have for, you know, 7, 8, 9 innings. So I go out there, I'm smarter, and I put a little on, take a little off, but I'm also in my reserve tank. So the point was we decided, we agreed, that if I went out there because I had a concern, he would always be honest, and his answer would be one of two things. He would say, what you see is what I have, which means better get me because you're worried. Or I'll tell you, no, hey, I've been, you know, just saving a little bit, but I can get out of this. I got some more to go. And he's the only pitcher with one asterisk, and this will be a great way to finish this, one asterisk in Game 7 in 2011. He's the only pitcher my whole career that I went out and asked him how he felt. And Tom would tell me, and give you an example. There was one time we were up by a run, second and third in the seventh inning, and Lloyd Mosby comes up, two outs. And I go out to Tom. I said, Tom, you know, it just looks like you're about to have it. He said, yeah, I'm getting tired. He said, but I can get Mosby out. He said, I'm going to get behind in the count, and then I'm going to throw him an off-speed pitch, and he's going to pop up to the left side. I agree. I walk out, I swear. Counts 3-1, throws him a change, but he pops up to the third baseman.
It's beautiful.
As he walks off the mound, he looks at me, he just winks. You know, this is Tom Seaver. I mean, the only guy. It's a true story. To this day, I'm just so sad and troubled that he gets this the Lyme disease, and he's not as sharp as he should be because he's got so much to offer. So, final asterisk, the one exception, and this is historic. You almost have to make this up in Hollywood, but This is true. And you probably have heard this. Maybe you've read it someplace. Karp is pitching game 7 against the Rangers. He's pitching on 3 days rest. We have a 2-run lead at 6. Dave and I look at each other and think, man, you know, we've pushed him far enough. And, you know, we should start the inning fresh. You know, our bullpen has been great. We still had 9 outs to get. But I thought, and so did Dave, that he had given us what he had. So we go to him as he's coming off in that middle part of the dugout. Nice going, Karp. Everybody sees it. They start patting him on the back. Yachty comes up to me and says, Skipper, you taking him out? I said, yeah. He says, oh, no, man, don't do it. He says, I've got a lot to work with them, to work there. And we had always had a philosophy when there's that much game left, if there's any doubt where the guy's being successful, just send him out, see if he can buy an out or two. And every time he buys an out, it's one less of the bullpen, right? So he says, and I went to Doug. I said, Doug, Yachty says, and it's because of our respect for well-deserved for Yachty, we said, hell, let's leave him in. So we went back to Karp. And Karp, he might have told you the story here the other day. I went back to Karp and says, Karp, Yachty says you got a lot to work with and just wondering about sending you back out there. He said, yeah, yeah, I'll go back out there. Well, he says later on, which he should have said, I was just shocked because it's never happened before. And sure enough, he goes up there, and Murphy's the hitter. And he throws a, you know, nice sinking fastball, strike one. Throws a hellacious breaking ball, strike two, man. I'm thinking, come on, man. Come on, Karp. See how many outs he gets. He hangs the 0-2 curveball, and Murphy hit a double in the right field corner. So I'm walking out to get him, and I am just cursing myself to the highest level, thinking we're going to lose this game because you went against this one thing, no matter how much you respect Yachty. And you know that run's going to score. We've got a 1-run game. We got a bunch of outs to go. Sure enough, in comes to Hotel and those guys, and they ended up not getting them over and in. And we ended up, we ended up winning by 4 runs. But that's, as in all, a true story. The only exception was Karp because of Yachty, and that was my respect for both of them. But when he went out there, he made a mistake and hung that breaking ball because Yachty was right. He had plenty left. He just made a mistake.
That is great.
Did Carlton Fisk ever do that? Did he ever tell you? Yeah. I mean, with the Seaver story, I don't know if he was catching that day or not, but did he have any input?
No, that was 84, yes. Yeah. Well, Pudge was always ready to have an opinion because he's very experienced, very smart. But he and Dunk had a great Dunk, you know how it is, Dunk. Dunk's related to probably one of the least known stories is how well Dunk communicated with and nursed his catchers along, just his pitchers. So, Pudge knew the process that I was going to make the decision coming out, and he always felt that it was one that Dunk agreed with. I'll give you one, though, that is also part of history. You got a few more minutes?
Yes,
yeah,
we have all the time in the world.
Okay. Okay, God. I mean, I thought I heard somebody snoring back there.
No, we're loving this, Skipper.
All right, so this is here again. This is true. We go to New York. Tom Seaver. Yeah, this is Hollywood. Can't make this up. Tom's going for 300. Where's he going? In Yankee Stadium in New York City. It's on a Sunday afternoon, and we're playing the Yankees. We have a 2-run lead, like the fifth or sixth inning. There's a play at the plate. Offensively for us, there's an umpire. I'm not going to mention his name. But our guys, you're sitting right there in front of you because you're on the third base side. Our guy slits in ahead of the tag. The tag is high on the leg. I mean, he's clearly safe. Umpire gets blocked out a little bit, and he rings him up. And I mean, we're all fired up. We got, we're pulling for Tom to win 300. And I come running out and lose control, and I end up bumping the umpire, so I get ejected. So I'm watching the game from the runway mostly. And it was really a terrible view. So now it's the eighth inning. He's still got a 2-run lead. Tom's still pitching. And you can tell that he's laboring. He gets two guys on base, and Dunk knows the philosophy. So he goes out there to talk to him, but to tell him, in his opinion, he'd done it all. And he said, and so Fisk comes to the meeting. There's Duncan, Seaver, and Fisk. And Dunk says, Tom, I mean, just looking at you, man, I think it's sure out of gas and it's time to get you. And he says, Doc, you know, I think you're right. All of a sudden, Fisk says, out of gas, you're Tom Seaver. This is your game. You got it in you. So he right there, he says, he just starts jumping on Seaver. Man, you know, you've got guts. You know, even though you're tired and everything, you got to win. Well, the hitter is Dave Winfield, man. So what did he do? He said, Dunk, you know, Fisk thinks, Buzz thinks I can get him. And Dunk says, okay, he walks off. So it's I've got this at bat, by the way, on tape. He makes every pitch, the sinker, the breaking ball, just everything was just off the edge or on the edge. He gets a 3-2. He throws him a 3-2 change, and he swings and misses. In the ninth inning, he goes back out there. We had a two-run lead. There's a guy, I think there's one guy on base. Harold made a play to start the inning to keep a leadoff double off base. I think there's one or two guys on base, and they pinch it. Don Baylor. Dunk doesn't even bother to go out. It just looks looking. They both nod at each other. And if you look, I've got a picture. I've got a picture they sent me, the photo of a Seaver looking in. You can see the exhaustion. And he makes a pitch. And if you watch his highlight all the time, his 300th win, he takes a swing and you think, oh boy, you know, pretty good fly to left field. Reed Nichols caught it and he won 300 and he pitched a complete game. And Fisk had that step forward and challenge him. Part of it that ended up wonderfully.
You're Tom
That's
Seaver.
Fantastic.
You're not a guest.
That's great to hear. Tony, your
Tom
story.
Seaver. You're not Brad Thompson.
That's right. That's right. And no business being there late in the game.
Oh, man. Tony, we always love hearing your stories, and we're always excited to have you. We wish it were opening day. We will have one. And as we approach when we get to real opening day and we are playing, we want to find out how things are going with the Angels. But we appreciate you taking some time and being so generous with your time today.
Well, you know, I'm a technical person, and I've been monitoring it. Your listenership has been clicking the radio off for the last 10 minutes, so I apologize.
Oh, no. Everybody's still here.
Blown up. We just got one a second ago, Skipper, that said they've been sitting in their car in the garage for the last 30 minutes. So people are loving this. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. See you later.
See you, Tony. That is the great Tony La Russa joining us here in the Fast Lane on 101 ESPN. It doesn't get any better than that.
I got a real quick tip, though. If you are listening in the garage,
turn the car off.
Yeah,
thank
turn
you.
The car off. Yeah, okay. We appreciate that. All right, coming up, we are going to hear from you. We're going to hear some of your mic drops, and then Matt Holliday is going to join us. Yeah, this is fun. Opening day on 101 ESPN.